he sort of surmises it here as what enlightenment is to have the courage to make use of your own understanding. And I think that that's so important because we can understand that Bitcoin has a fixed supply of 21 million. But unless you have the courage and the conviction to lean into that and to say, you know what, I'm going to take on the risk of owning my own Bitcoin. If you can't do that, it doesn't matter.
What's up, fellow Bitcoiners? I'm John Chenow, and welcome to episode 13 of the Bitcoin Path podcast. This is a show where we have deeper conversations about Bitcoin and self-sovereignty, about how this new magic internet money is changing the world and changing ourselves at the same time. In this episode, I'm really excited to share with you session number 5 of the Cosmic Deep Dive with Eric Kaysen. This was an interactive online event that took place on December 12th and the 13th of 2020. It was 2 full days of back-to-back immersive Bitcoin educational webinars with some of the leading educators in the space. This was just an amazing experience of growth and a deep collaborative discussion that we had with everyone that attended and all the instructors that were involved. This discussion that Eric leads is just very practical, very timely given the current situation. So keep an eye out for more events like this one coming up at thebitcoinpath.com. Also, you can find Eric on Twitter with the handle at Eric Kaysen. With that, let's get into this episode.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to session number 5 of the Cosmic Deep Dive event. I'm John Chenow, and joining me today is Eric. Eric Kaysen is a crypto anarchist, a farmer, an iconoclast. He's obsessed with Bitcoin and has been working in the industry since 2013. Eric has a deep understanding of cryptography technology and brings a unique perspective with his research in philosophy, political theory, and economics. Eric has contributed just some amazing articles on his Medium page and is just a tremendous thought leader in the community. And I'm just really grateful to have him on. I've thoroughly enjoyed my conversations with him, just on all aspects, the practical, on the philosophical, the deeper realms of the rabbit hole, so to speak, as well as the practical ramifications of how this new technology is affecting us on a personal level and at a societal level as well. So Eric, with that, I will let you have the floor.
Thanks, John. So kind of before I go in, if you guys have any questions at any point, feel free to put it into the chat box, or also just feel free to unmute yourself and jump in. I want to leave a pretty loose and open format for people to, you know, for us to kind of go down whatever rabbit holes pop up and to, you know, follow those threads. I really appreciated what Max did here earlier. I thought that was a great format. And I also think that it was challenging in certain regards, because when we get kind of put on the spot like that, we can feel very anxious because I guess this is a great kind of segue and into the direction of how I was going to start my talk. First of all, I'd finished reading this book, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Great and interesting book, and it was used in the 1970s by Paulo Freire to do what he calls critical pedagogy, which this is the process of co-creating with individuals dialogues that allow for them to start learning about what sort of oppression is around them vis-a-vis the educational model, you know. And so maybe the greatest example of that can happen is people that are prevented from learning how to read because of kind of their circumstances that they're put within. They can't read, they can never acquire the knowledge that they need in order to liberate themselves from the conditions of their oppression. And a large part of that is critical questioning of things. So the way that we just did a Socratic method with Max is a good example of that. It is, what sort of questions do we actually allow for ourselves to ask and to wrestle with in order to have a deeper and more thorough understanding of things. And so I think Max did a great job of helping with that on the actual technical front. Like, what are some of the nitty gritties on the technological side of how Bitcoin operates? What does it do for us? How does it help us? And I think through that same process, where we were going is eventually going to have a much more robust discussion of, you know, how does Taproot and some of these more powerful operations that are coming into Bitcoin, how are they going to help us as entrepreneurs or individuals who are trying to protect our wealth? And so I want to look at this from kind of the other side of, when we first get involved with Bitcoin, it seems that there's usually some thread that attracts us here. And once we start kind of critically questioning it, it first starts with money, but it keeps going deeper and deeper and deeper into wealth, into eventually what law is, how law functions, and its place kind of in our society. And again, if you guys have any questions, feel free to just kind of pop up with a hand and ask what you would like to. Also, John, however much you want to facilitate, you're welcome to as well. And so with this, kind of where I want to go is kind of, I want to do a broad overview of the way that I see and understand Bitcoin and how it's important to me. And I think for myself, the best way that I can explain sort of the rabbit hole that I dove down was once I got started involved in Bitcoin, I was deeply intrigued with this question of how is it that the Bitcoin network itself can maintain its total obligation to this promise to me that so long as I don't reveal my public or my private key to anybody else, it will always be able to store and protect my Bitcoin. And so I think that this is a really important question, because the idea of an oath or a promise is actually at the very base of our entire social contract, you know? And so I think kind of the first step is, there's another book here, Hobbes's Leviathan. It's sort of the first book that was ever demonstrated around statecraft. And within Leviathan, one of the things that Hobbes presents is this idea that all that creates sovereign power is the ability to be able to offer a kind of safety and protection that nobody else can offer. Like, that's fundamentally what the king did, was that he was able to stand behind this idea of saying, hey, I can offer you safety. I can offer you this operation of law that's going to always be able to kind of contain what that promise means. And so this was actually a very important development in the creation of the state as we understand it today. Because before 1648, there weren't these strong demarcation lines around what a nation state was and how the state itself was able to function necessarily without a monarch. And so in 1648, after the Treaty of Westphalia, that also ended the 30 Years' War in Europe, essentially we went from an operation of saying, hey, the monarch has full power to kind of decide what he can do with his subjects and how he does it, to a pretty important transition to saying, actually, it's no longer just the monarch, but it's the apparatus of the state itself. They're going to create all of the mechanizations in order to protect people and to offer them law. So this opened up like a few pretty different pathways, but one of the most important ones was being able to actually kind of cleanse the state of the monarchical operations that they had. And so while on one hand, this is good that we moved away from there being a single monarch or sovereign that has full purvey over the law, it moved into an operation of having a much more greater bureaucratic operations going on with that. And again, this operation, it worked decently for several centuries. But the problem is where we're at today, we have been left with this gigantic bureaucracy, all of which aren't necessarily elected or have any sort of democratic overview on them, in addition to the fact that they're welcome to kind of utilize their own corruption of the law itself to favor themselves and to disfavor others. So the importance of this is that now we're at a place where the law itself no longer is actually really the law. It's actually this kind of mechanism that individuals within a bureaucratic state can use and manipulate and contort the law to appeal to itself. And so the great importance of this is that that original portion of the social contract that we spoke of, the ability to offer somebody a kind of safety or protection that no other can, doesn't actually operate anymore. And so this idea of it no longer operating is called the sovereign exception. Essentially, the sovereign can always step outside or beyond the law, specifically in a context of an emergency. It can go, oh, there's this crisis that's a threat to the state directly. And because of this crisis, we can actually step over and beyond the law. And this is part of the operation that we saw happen in World War II on both fronts. Internally, the Nazis in Germany, they were able to say, hey, the Jews and the communists present such a threat to the German state. We're going to give ourselves the right and the responsibility to liquidate them from being part of our state. And then on the Allies side, they also said, look, like what Nazi Germany is doing here is horrific and, you know, something that we need to respond to. So we're also going to step beyond the law, declare war, and go to a total war with Germany. So we now have entered into this territory, I'd say around the end of World War II, where states had realized that they can use a state of emergency in order to go beyond the law itself. No longer did you actually need to have outright legislation in order to be able to create protocols for governance, but you could just declare a state of emergency and then have legislators or executives kind of do whatever they chose within that context. So the reason why I'm pedantic about this is because this idea, the state of emergency, it always creates a condition to where governments can step over and beyond whatever power is given to them within the context of a law. So how does that relate to us in Bitcoin? Well, with Bitcoin, we can utilize the strong cryptography that is inside of it in order to create a social contract with the network and with other individuals in that network, a strength within the protocol that can never actually be broken unless we reveal that private key. So this allows for us the capacity to actually overcome the state whenever they deem they have a right or responsibility to take somebody's wealth away or to persecute them. Normally, under the context of the law, they can kind of carry that out however they want, against whomever they want, however they can. But if we start securing our wealth using Bitcoin, it means that even if they use all of their military strength, all of their power, all of their brutality, they can't actually extract our Bitcoin from us unless we give them that private key. Which I also want to be clear, you know, if somebody shows up with a wrench to beat the crap out of you, and you know you have only a single private key that's protecting it, you're probably going to give it over. I mean, I know I absolutely will, because I don't like getting beat with a wrench. But as we were talking about earlier with multi-sig and other schemes, there starts to become this very interesting cat and mouse game of how we can protect our Bitcoin, even if that were to happen, how we can use fallback schemes in order to protect our wealth. Even if we wanted to try to give up our Bitcoin, we can have protocols baked in to make sure that our wealth will never actually fall into the hands of the state or any other actors that are kind of ne'er-do-wellers or violent thugs that would like to extract our wealth from us. So, okay, the sort of moving onward from here. So we can now say that we now have this new way to protect our wealth, and that's pretty spectacular, frankly, that we couldn't have imagined before. And to me, one of the most important things here is also in Leviathan, one of the ways that Hobbes surmises like what the sovereign body politic is that a commonwealth is actually like an artificial animal, or what he also calls a mortal god, that's constructed by the convents of men in the interest of security, justice, and peace for them all. So part of my hypothesis of what Bitcoin actually is that it is fundamentally a new kind of social contract, a social contract that's actually using the internet directly in order for us to enter into an agreement of the commonality of our wealth to be shared according to the equality of the protocol, which this very much actually looks like the original idea of what the social contract is and how the agreement within that happens. However, what's distinctly different about this social contract versus contemporary ones is that our social contract removes the clause of violence from it in totality. So the contemporary social contract is this idea: you belong to the nation state of the United States. You're a subject of the United States government. And there's a sort of false notion that we've somehow entered into contract with them, where we gave up sovereignty in order to participate within their legal framework so that we can have equal protection of the law under that. Well, this is all kind of a false bullshit notion. First of all, we're just subjects. We never actually made any consensual agreement to kind of enter into the social contract that we are within. In addition to the fact of that, any kind of authority figures within our social construct, be it a judge, a police officer, someone with exorbitant wealth, they can usually do whatever they want to break the social contract in explicit ways to, either steal from you, to extract wealth from you, to, in the state, if you don't pay your taxes, they can throw you in jail, they can do all sorts of things. So what's of particular importance is that by us making a choice to put our wealth into Bitcoin and to start collaboratively participating with one another in this new structure of wealth, I think what we've actually done is we've discovered a way to create the commonwealth vis-a-vis the internet directly and through cryptography personally. And the more and more of us that join this network and realize that we can protect our wealth beyond the power of the state, but even beyond the state, just the violence that, an individual criminal network could bring to us or any others, it opens up a very new and different spectacular possibility that never existed before. The possibility of a digital commonwealth, one that's beyond and past nation states of the past and their orders of authority. And this is extremely important.
Go ahead. Real quick here, just to jump in here, can you kind of elaborate on the basic understanding of the Commonwealth? How did that function in society? Sure. And how that relates?
Sure. This is actually something I've been working on for a while. But first of all, the word Commonwealth itself comes from the Latin term res publica, which res publica actually means the public thing in Latin. It's the most public thing, actually. And I think it's quite interesting that we could also say that Bitcoin, in terms of being a public network and essentially a wealth network, it is the most public thing. There is no other network that people can access vis-a-vis the digital realm that can control wealth, that is also going to respect their property rights in the same way. And also this relates closer to another term, and this is, I have this laid out in an essay called Crypto Truth and Power, that this is actually very similar to this form of agreements that the first communes in Europe in the 12th century started to use. And it was a formation of fellowship oath with one another, to where instead of individuals taking an oath to an individual sovereign king, where they say, I give up my sovereignty to you in order for your love and protection and majesty that the king have, they actually made a totally different kind of agreement, and it was called Eintopfgrofen. And it sort of translates to like fellowship oath. And the idea was that through me taking an oath to the fellowship, I am making a promise that there's an equality of law according to my obligation to the contract, according to your obligation to the contract. And what this allowed the communes of the 12th and 13th century to do was to actually organize themselves into collectives where no individual actually had rule over them, but it was actually through a rule of the fellowship that they all had a total obligation to. And so that's pretty cool, because essentially this is this methodology in order to figure out a new and different way to create a commonwealth without needing to be fully reliant upon a sovereign in order to actualize the law. They were able to actualize the law together through the mutualized oath and promise that they took to one another. So moving forward also, the word commonwealth, it also derives from the idea of health and well-being. So what does it mean to have a collective that looks towards one another's care and well-being? Well, circling all the way back to where we originally started with Hobbes, that's actually kind of the most fundamental basic framework of what the social contract is and the agreement with the sovereign is that they can provide a protection to you that none other can provide. Well, what does it mean now that we've inverted these equations, that no longer can I look to the United States government for a guarantee and promise to protect my wealth because they've, you know, made it very clear that they have a right to an emergency decrees. And if they find me as a citizen in violation of certain principles that they don't necessarily even need to make me aware of, they can declare me an enemy combatant, deprive me of habeas corpus, strip me of my property rights, strip me of my money that are in banks and stuff. And so I don't actually have the full guarantee of the law. I don't have that capacity to know and be assured by the sovereign state that I'll actually get access to the law. Which, if any of you are familiar with Kafka, this is actually pretty close to the parable of before the law, you know, and that essentially we're sort of asking for this idea of getting access to the law, but there's essentially a guard in front of us saying, you know, we'll maybe give you access to the law, but we have to kind of go through this whole bureaucratic process first. And what ends up happening is we're actually just kind of waiting for access to the law forever. We never actually get access to it, or we're always delayed from getting access to it until we eventually die, you know, and what we're seeing with the cases of Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, other whistleblowers is that this is the same methodology playing out, is they're deprived of the ability of the law and to go to trial through all of these sort of ideas that allow for the state to move beyond the law itself and to allow for themselves the total authority to make the decision of what the law is. Well, we should all be deeply, deeply alarmed by this because, like, this actually isn't law anymore. It's just raw authoritarianism. And, you know, it's problematic because it means at any point in time, and us explicitly as Bitcoiners, I would say, and seeing the legislation that's coming through now should be pretty clear to anybody, it is very, very clear that the state can label any of us as being enemy combatants, enemy of the state, whatever you want. But essentially, they have non-democratic means to be able to circumnavigate the law in such a way to declare a state of emergency to rob people of their wealth. And actually, that's something that's happened before in the United States. And not just in the United States, there was a whole series of governmental decrees between 1933 all the way up to 1967 that made similar declarations stripping people of their ability to hold gold. Most famously is Executive Order 6102 in the United States, one of the first pieces of legislation passed by FDR, that essentially allowed for him and his officers to go into banks to seize their gold deposits and to give them an equivalent US dollar amount, which that's very generous of them to steal and to give back the equivalent value. However, as we all know with economics, that's not really how it works. You can't just steal something and replace it and say, hey, it's worth the same amount. So within a year, the price of gold had essentially doubled. The individuals that were given those dollar amounts had their value depreciate by, you know, about half. And there wasn't anything they could do about it. And this is very important because this is the same direction that we're going now. And it seems very clear that the state is going to want to say, hey, you guys can't transact without us monitoring everything. Hey, you need to know your customers, whoever they may be. Hey, you need to implement these various surveillance methods for us to watch how and where people are transacting with each other. So this is all alarming because, first of all, they have no right to do that. It's not stipulated anywhere that they have the ability to do these things, to monitor us, to surveil us, to take our money if they don't agree with us. But more importantly, to me, what it signals is that we're no longer really in this theater of being individual citizens that are participating in the collective that is our democracy to create consensual power. It actually seems to be something very different. And to me, what that signals is that we're no longer actually a commonwealth. We're actually something else. We're just subjects underneath a regime. And so I believe that through us participating in Bitcoin and the network and growing it and putting our wealth here, that this is actually a focal point. It's a focal point for the globe to show up together to say, hey, we no longer want governments being able to readily steal from us for whatever cause they choose. We no longer want to be part of financial surveillance networks where we have to ask for permission on what to spend our money on. And part of kind of this critical pedagogy of going through all of this, it's important that with each step we sort of observe more deeply, because what I'm trying to convey is that this idea that we all participate in the freest republic in the world, that we have rights that are absolutely guaranteed by the Constitution, and that there's always a process of jurisprudence to be able to go through in order to ensure our access and equality within the law, it's actually more or less a fantasy. And I'm not saying that to be rude or to put anybody down, but that, like, when we actually look at the direct facts of what's going on, there's very little that's left of our actual purported democracy or even Republican processes at this point in time, because of how incredibly and thoroughly corrupt the entire framework has become. And so for me, what it means is that by us showing up at Bitcoin, participating in it, putting our wealth in it, interacting with other people within it, we're starting to get the very base of a new political structure. A new political structure where we choose to utilize the internet directly and collectives of peers working together in different networks and nodes to recreate a commonwealth. And I think Bitcoin is sort of the very, very base layer of this new commonwealth. And that word commonwealth, I think, is actually a perfect and fitting example of what it truly is. We are choosing to put our wealth together collectively in this new sort of network that offers us all the same sort of property rights and guarantees to every individual in the network, no matter what. And furthermore, the only identifying portions of what the network itself looks like is vis-a-vis the public key, which this allows for a total homogenizing operation. That means no longer can you actually identify individuals within the system to single them out. And this pairs all up much better with an essay I have called The Sovereign, the Subject, and Crypto Power, which is about how we can utilize cryptography itself to explicitly protect our identity so that the operations of the state, in order to actually discover who we are, to place mechanisms of control and power onto us, no longer have the ability to actually function. Because through the Bitcoin network, when utilizing privacy protocols correctly, you can't actually just single somebody out and say, hey, you can't do that, you can't do this. And it's actually going to be pretty fascinating to see kind of how this KYC legislation plays out. I'm going to be interested to see in what has to happen. So I've been blabbing for a little bit now. I just kind of wanted to check in real quick to see if anybody had any particular questions or lines that they would like for me to go on, or anything about kind of my specific writings that they would like me to open up a bit more about.
Eric, where would you place the odds of, like, a, you know, 6102 like decree and kind of on what timeline? I think, what was it, Brian Brooks the other week, who, you know, sort of made an effort to say, oh, you know, no one's killing it, you know, I want two laws as opposed to 50, you know, blah, 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 blah. I think that's probably a lot of kind of rhetoric. And then the second question is, like, how does game theory play into that on kind of a nation state level in terms of, you know, certain jurisdictions being more, you know, kind of open to it? Like, how does that potentially play into, you know, another nation state's kind of decision to be more sort of open or closed to new technology like this?
Great questions. So I think in regards to, like, what's the possibility of a 6102 event? You know, I'm going to place it really high. Because I mean, like, the quote unquote problems with the Bitcoin network are very real. You know, if Hezbollah or ISIS or whoever wants to fundraise in Bitcoin to go conduct some large terrorist attack, they're absolutely free to do that. Is that a problem with the Bitcoin network directly? No. Like, it's a general problem that happens when you have free money and finance to happen. So I expect for some not so good events to kind of focus around Bitcoin. And when that happens, I see the state of emergency being this decree that they'll be able to use to easily attack and go after Bitcoin. And on kind of the second level, on the game theory of it, like, to me, this is actually where stuff starts to get super interesting. Is so we've already seen, you know, explicitly in the United States, I can't comment as much on other regimes, but in the United States, it's really interesting to think about how various states are starting to pass their own legislation in regards to Bitcoin. You know, on one side, we have stuff like New York State and their Bit license, which has been pretty restrictive to the industry on the whole and the ability to do transactions and to develop various entrepreneurial pursuits in the state of New York. Whereas on the opposite side, you have a state like Wyoming, where it's very clear that there are Bitcoiners that are working with legislators directly, that they have an understanding of what Bitcoin is, and that they want to structure the laws in such a way to be as friendly as possible. But I think because of kind of how powerful what's going on is and about what it means to control wealth, is I actually think that this is a really great front for states to essentially start challenging the federal government in a really powerful way. All the way to the extent of, you know, this is in my fantasy world, I'm not sure if it would actually happen, but essentially for states to respond to the federal government to actually say, you know what, not only do you not have a right to legislate around all these new digital currencies and things, but we're not really interested in paying back, you know, the $4 trillion that you just printed up to give to all your cronies and buddies. We're actually going to refuse United States federal debt, and we're going to issue our own, you know, cryptocurrency, which will essentially be a state mandated fiat currency that they're able to create. And in my opinion, it would be very powerful to have all 50 states doing their own private currency issuance in order to fundraise and to you know, create whatever kind of mechanisms they want for their money. I think most states would mismanage that and kind of wreck their economy with it. But I do think that it's a very interesting model of game theory. Furthermore, with that being said, let's say the feds pass draconian legislation, states fall in line with that. I think it just becomes pretty great opportunity for, you know, essentially the way that it played out in the 20th century is when you have a hostile regime that's attacking its citizens, saying they're going to hurt them, people are going to move with their feet, you know. And as somebody who has like resided in California their whole life, I really love this place and it means a lot to me. I can say for myself, even if very draconian legislation came down, I would consider moving with my feet. And I think as this process plays out, we're going to find there will be jurisdictions that will be very friendly to crypto entrepreneurs and individuals saying, hey, if you want to go ahead and pay a one-time fee of, you know, 100,000 euros or whatever, in addition to X, Y, and Z, you can come set up shop here. We'll give you visas and you'll be good to go. And I think we're just entering into that latter phase where it's clear that we're going to see nation states start trying to pass their own legislation around Bitcoin and crypto explicitly. And as that plays out, frankly, I'm pretty excited because I think that that's also where we're going to be able to reactively respond. In addition to the fact that I think these are the sort of exacerbations that Bitcoiners need to like kind of get in front of this. Like one of the things I'm the most excited for is seeing a strong political group present itself where their only job essentially is to work with state and federal legislatures to try to get, you know, Bitcoin protective legislation passed. Because to me, like winning looks like essentially a constitutional amendment gets passed saying that, you know, the United States federal government can no longer issue currency through their private institutions like the Federal Reserve, and that moving forward, people have the freedom to utilize whichever currency they choose to use, be it Bitcoin, shitcoin, or anything in between. But it's all going to be very interesting because, you know, I don't foresee a future where they're going to be very friendly. You know, to me, it seems much more like one to where they're going to want to put down some pretty stringent requirements around how you can utilize your Bitcoin and what that looks like. So that was a pretty long-winded answer. I hope that that addressed some of the topic.
Yeah, really helpful. Makes a lot of sense.
Cool. Any other questions as I kind of move forward? Excellent. So now I'd like to sort of switch gears a little bit, because originally I had started with this idea of kind of the pedagogy of Bitcoin. And now I'd like to sort of move a little bit farther along towards, so what are some of these questions that are coming up, you know, about Bitcoin and what it's doing? And I'd actually like to even ask like a more wider question about what really is crypto? And when I say crypto, I'm not just talking about the wider ecosystem of Bitcoin, but I think the word itself reveals something quite interesting, and that the word crypto, kind of in Latin, it just means to be concealed, to be hidden. And somehow through this concealment mechanism, we've created this, you know, what I've surmised as being a new form of digital and social contract. But why is it that this power explicitly seems to create something new and novel and different for us? How is it that through what Satoshi created, he sort of gathered together all of these different pieces, you know, because I'm not sure if you guys know, but Satoshi didn't actually invent anything terribly new within Bitcoin as much as he brought together all of these various features in such a way. And I think that this is very important, because what it sort of shows is that Satoshi, as I've called him like an artist or a poet, was that he was able to look at all of these various things and gather them in such a way to say, well, we live in this world where the nation state can attack us and can steal our money. How can I utilize cryptography in order to gather these things together in such a way to protect people, to offer them a new and different form of money and wealth? And to me, this kind of links back to the entire arc of what cryptography is about. Is this idea of concealing your communication in such a powerful and stringent way so that others can't break that communication, they can't spy on that communication or utilize that against you. And to me, this kind of links up to my own thesis of that cryptography was explicitly developed for a purpose of war. And within that purpose of war, so an individual, even if they're being spied upon, can create a secure communication with another individual in order to communicate, you know, troop movements, supply movements, whatever they need be. But nested inside of that is it's a very real tactic of war. And so by us having extracted this tactic of war in such a way to protect ourselves, I think what it signals a lot is that this is actually a form of technology that's allowing for us to actually carry out our own sort of hidden civil wars against their own respective governments. Because if they could have their way right now, nobody would have any cryptography, Bitcoin wouldn't exist, and we would all be good little citizens that go to school, pay our taxes, eat our fiat food, and, you know, comply with every demand that's put towards us. But unfortunately for them, cryptography is out of the cage. There's no way to put it back. There's no way to take that knowledge away from people. And I also want to point out that cryptography, it's always had its use and its capacity within digital networks and frameworks to do what it's been doing. And even within kind of the crypto wars in the 1990s, there were strong efforts to push that cryptography into the hands of normal people. But Bitcoin unequivocally has accelerated this process in a very dramatic way. We can now say that we have deployed cryptographic systems that, you know, laymen across the board can utilize powerfully and easily. And so this has opened up a whole new topology of war to us. Essentially, now the internet itself has become part of this playing field, where we can actually utilize the internet in this kind of generalized civil war against our own governments to not only protect ourselves and our identities, but now we can protect our wealth as well. And through that method of being able to protect our wealth as well, it allows for a new commonwealth to be created that can allow for us to actualize a lot of the ideals that have been put down in our respective constitutions. So any questions at this point, any elaborations kind of on where I'm going?
I think, Eric, just as I hear you speaking, I think a lot of people, when they hear just that phrase that we might potentially be at war with our own government, though it's in the informational realm, it's a very sobering thought.
I'd like to emphasize, we've been at war with our own government for a very long time. And like this is going back to that idea of crypto, it's actually a hidden and secret war. It's something that goes on against your mind all the time. It's why when you turn on the TV, there's advertisement that's selling you sludge as food. It's the reason why you're told that going to college is the right pathway that's going to serve you. It's the reason why you're told that if you do any drugs that aren't prescribed to you, it's going to hurt you and it's going to harm you. And in the same way as the critical pedagogy of what we were talking about earlier, about looking at what money is critically, one of the key things with Bitcoin that I think most of us have probably encountered is talking to somebody and saying, hey, have you heard about this Bitcoin thing? And they go, you're dumb, or that can't work, or this, that, or the other isn't true. And that is also part of this civil war that's going on against us. We've been taught from the very beginning that this idea that our great father or mother of the government loves and cares about us, and they issue the US dollar in such a very specific way to create only 2% inflation because that's the best thing that helps most of us, right? It's bullshit. And we can tell it's bullshit because of the way that it has irreparably harmed us historically. And we have example after example after example after example of this. But furthermore, when we try to challenge these structures, when we say, well, you know, we are a democratic republic, that we are supposed to have accountability from government officials, and yet somehow we've ended up with this system where a private banking system owned by the wealthiest institutions that have ever been created get to make the decision about how we issue money. You know, we come into what's arguably a very real crisis where the state can say, hey, we can actually utilize our emergency powers to help prevent, you know, what has been this cataclysmic pandemic. We can utilize that money in a very powerful and strong way to help stimulate the economy, help people out, yada, yada, yada. What we get instead is them printing out more money than they have ever done in the entire history of the United States. And they give that money to their friends and their cronies. Meanwhile, we have people going to food banks at an all-time high, people not being able to pay their rent at an all-time high, all of these crises, and they can't help us. They can't find the money to give people a little bit more. So to me, that this is all part of the conditions of the civil war that we're already part of, and that we've been part of for a very long time, and that we inherited. And that's an interesting thing about civil war as well. And also, actually, I have a book here called Stasis by Giorgio Ambigan. Giorgio Ambigan's probably like my leading philosophical figure that I follow. And stasis is the Latin term for civil war. It meant like a disruption, disagreement within the family. And what's interesting about a civil war is that it's never declared. There's never a place where people wave flags and say, we have declared civil war against one another. No, it's actually about the framework of the law itself going into breakdown. And that's actually what we saw here in the United States during the American Civil War, was essentially this breakdown between the idea of what decrees can the federal government put down and what decrees can the state put down and what happens when they come into conflict. And one of the things we've also been told is that this has now been settled, that the federal government can declare war against states, they will stomp them out, and if states try to independently do that for themselves, they'll declare war. And it's very interesting because we're also seeing some sentiments of the idea of secession right now and of the idea of sovereign self-determination by states. And it's very clear that the federal government has no interest in it, in addition to they want to make every single citizen understand and know, if you try to create self-determination for yourself, for your state, or for other individuals around you, we are going to come to you with violence and hurt you. And so part of why I'm kind of going down this pathway is that I think this idea that there is a secret war that's going on against you by a whole various number of factions, because it's not just the government, but it's also media and advertising and consumerism on a whole, but the way that we're educated, the way that we think about the idea of health, you know, like another great example of this is that our governments have used COVID as an excuse to irreparably but to destroy the economy across the board, specifically targeting small to mid-sized businesses, saying, hey, you can or can't do that. And meanwhile, what's the opportunity cost? We have a disease that's killing, it seems like at its best, it's killing maybe 1.5% of people that get it. And again, I don't want to detract from that. It's deadly, it's scary, it's different. But does that give the government a right to destroy people's livelihood? Does it give a right for them to say people have to utilize their house as a prison structure, that they can't leave? I don't think so. And I think it goes to show how radically removed our governments have made themselves from law. And something that was presented to me recently is the idea that, you know, the idea of our constitutions, these are not documents that create governmental power. They're documents that explicitly limit governmental power. And even within those limits, we're still seeing very dramatic things go on, you know, like whatever the president of the United States is tweeting, whether it's true, false, or otherwise, we're finding that private corporations are able to censor even the president of the United States because they don't like what he's saying, because they say it's not true. And again, I'm not contesting the truth of it at all, or whether it's good or bad or otherwise. What I'm trying to stipulate is that there was never supposed to be a place where they could limit that, even if they wanted to. And so I think moving forward, I just really want people to be thoughtful and critical about how there is this constant war against them in such a way to try to keep them oppressed, unintelligent, slow, fat, hurt, sad. Because when you have all of these things pressed upon somebody, it's very easy to manipulate them. It's very easy to take control and power over them. And I think a great example with Bitcoin directly is Bitcoin forces you to take self-sovereignty over your wealth, but also to take power over the fate of what's going to happen to your wealth. And I think it's very easy to get stuck in a mindset where somebody goes, well, you have no idea what will happen with Bitcoin. You're not a cryptographer. You can't tell what's actually going on. The whole system could fail. You could lose all of your money. And everything that's part of that system is dedicated towards making you live in fear and terror. And to say, I can't do any of this on my own. I need to go find a wealth or a finance advisor. I'm too dumb to understand this stuff. I need to go to these experts to help me. Well, that, again, going back to critical pedagogy, like that's not education at all. That's this idea that you are somehow empty. You can't figure it out on your own. And the only possible way to do that is to come to an expert who can fill you up with these things. And that's not actually education at all. That's actually just an authoritarian framework. Whereas if we can enter into a dialogue together, go, oh, so what do you understand about money? What is an investment to you? How does deflation work? And for us to enter into a deep dialogue about these things, there starts to construct an understanding that becomes deeper. And to me, I think one of the most powerful moves that somebody can understand is like, ah, Bitcoin is a risk. And I do understand how me misutilizing my private key, me not protecting it correctly, me keeping my keys stored on exchange, they all introduce risk. But to also make the pivot and to look at our current systems of government to say, my bank can obviously steal money directly out of my bank account if they want to, that a police officer could call up the bank and tell them, hey, this Kaysen guy is clearly bad news, shut down his bank account. Or another, you know, there's also instances of maybe the bank believes that something fraudulent is going on and they can just shut down access to my bank account. These are also risks that are entailed, you know, not to mention something like when coronavirus finally did get to be acknowledged to be the crisis that some believed it was, the market crashed in a cataclysmic way that nobody could have expected before. And the dialogue that we're always given, though, is that this market-based mechanism, invest in your 401k and the stock market, this shit's all safe. And it's just not true. And so I think that this idea of critical pedagogy, of looking at things together, of trying to create a questioning that allows for us a deeper understanding is very important. In addition to the fact of that, it's also very scary. It's really scary because as we start to pull these things apart, we can see how disempowered we are. We go, oh, geez, it turns out I can't do any of this stuff. It turns out that, I don't know cryptography. Maybe I am fucking all of this up, like it is a risk. Like what happens if I lose a bunch of money, And it's all predicated upon building these fears in us as opposed to trying to build up courage in us. And that courage is one of the key aspects. And I actually, I have an essay here I've been reading from Immanuel Kant about, it's titled, An Answer to the Question of What is Enlightenment? And I really love that he sort of surmises it here as what enlightenment is to have the courage to make use of your own understanding. And I think that that's so important because we can understand that Bitcoin has a fixed supply of 21 million. We can understand that as more people come into this network, that it should inherently deflate on its own and the value of each coin should continue to go up. But unless you have the courage and the conviction to lean into that and to say, you know what, I'm going to take on the risk of owning my own Bitcoin, of putting my wealth into it, and of taking on the subjective risk of what it means to hold Bitcoin, if you can't do that, it doesn't matter. And that's very important because we need to have this critical pedagogy going on and developing dialogue with ourselves and others in order to get a deeper understanding. So A, we can allay the sort of fear and terror module that we've been given and to replace it with one that's full of courage and self-knowledge. Did you have something to say, John?
Yeah, I'm just kind of I'm just kind of amazed by this. Like I just see this great bifurcation happening or polarization where people are being cornered into more and more fear, more and more debilitating lack of control, a victim mindset of you don't know what's going on. You can't understand what's going on. So you need to trust us to take care of you in every single way. Meanwhile, what I see in the Bitcoin realm is the complete opposite of that, where it's like, no, you are responsible. You need to take control of this. You need to understand this. You need to put in the work to secure your own freedom in this way. My mind is just being blown by the absolute contrasting nature of what you're talking about.
Well, and I think it's pretty interesting that kind of part of this whole equation is I actually think what's going on is we're starting to rediscover like the classic Greek idea of what self-care means. I think in the modern world, we and this is also an idea that's extracted from Michel Foucault. He has a book called, I'm trying to remember what the title is exactly, but it's about this idea of what self-care is. And so the ancient Greeks, they had this idea that self-care was this iterative process of reflecting on ourselves and of trying to achieve a closer and closer ideal towards who and how we want to be in the world, done first and primarily through ensuring that you're taking care of yourself. And I think what Bitcoin does is it wants people to take that radical self-care of themselves, because it starts from first principles of saying, look, we have all of these examples of the government again and again, not just not taking care of its people, but of actively creating the largest crimes, if you could even call them crimes, that have happened in human history. You know, the 20th century, more so than any other century, is a story about governments radically going outside of their power and purview in order to label explicit groups of people enemies of the state so that they can kill them, you know. And it, throughout the 20th century, you had the Arminians in the 1920s, you had the starvation of the Ukrainian people by the Stalin Soviets in the 30s, you had the Holocaust in the 1940s, you had the killing fields of Cambodia in the 1970s, you know, the list goes on and on and on and on. And I think as a student of history, it's really important to understand these things so that we can come to a first principle of saying, look, the first order of self-care is making sure that if these sort of circumstances were to actually happen to you, that you have a way to prevent it from happening, that you have a way that you can protect your wealth, your family, your friends, whomever you can, if such a circumstance was to happen. And I think Bitcoin is realistically the only methodology that we actually have right now to give ourselves a total assurance that the state can never step beyond those limitations of power. And I think through us choosing to utilize this more and more, what I find is actually even more fascinating is how Bitcoin seems to actually be a general shilling point for everybody who cares about this to show up and start working together. And I think that, more so than any other time I've been involved in Bitcoin, we're now reflecting this back and forth to each other. We're in deeper dialogue about this, about what's going on, how we feel, how we can resist. And I think that, in my opinion, this is actually the most powerful feature of Bitcoin, is not all of the cryptographic protocols and other things that are rooted inside of it, but our ability to understand how these things protect us in such a way that it offers us an assurance and guarantee that is beyond the power of a nation state, which fundamentally, because of what we discover here, I think that this is actually the basis of an entirely new sovereign form that, you know, I'm not sure if we'll necessarily see it in our lifetime, but to me, it makes sense that we utilize this organizational format to start creating new political collectives and affinity groups that can offer us assurances and guarantees beyond that of the nation state. And this enters into a pretty interesting dialogue because, you know, I'm an anarchist. I believe that we want to destroy the state in its entirety. But I want to be very, very clear that I'm not talking about organizational systems, you know, because a lot of times you'll have, you know, the classic libertarian question of who will build the roads? Well, the nice thing is that in the future, there's probably going to be a number of very interesting and innovative methodologies to do that, whether it's paying individual road taxes for driving, whether it's having city council affinity groups that pay for a road and tax it through their commerce. Whatever, what ends up happening is there becomes this very new and different way to organize. And I guess the equivalent of what I would say that looks like is similar to during the Spanish Civil War, when the Republican movement paired itself with the anarcho-syndicalists. You know, they essentially created a number of different syndicates throughout Spain that were able to work collaboratively with each other to, you know, kind of create the conditions of liberty that they needed. And granted, it was very messy and difficult at times. And I think that this is what it'll look like in that transition. But I think because of the way, as we were talking with Max earlier, how, you know, we're opening up these new methods through stuff like Schnorr signatures to create more complex transaction types, that essentially, like, each level we kind of go up, there becomes more and more interesting forms of organization that can allow for us to solve these problems and with better ways and methods.
100%. And I think that's a really helpful explanation and clarification for others who might be observing this and watching, who are, you know, these are somewhat new concepts for some people to be grappling with, because we are sort of brainwashed in this society to think that no, government good, government is God, government, we pledge allegiance to the flag, you know, that is the flag is the representation of freedom. And those who fight, those who serve the government, those who are laying down their lives for the government are laying down their lives for freedom. And so it can be sometimes a paradigm shift that's very difficult for people to go beyond, because it's a very emotional thing that people are attached to as well. But I'd love to hear from the audience. I think this is a great point for anyone else to jump in and share their thoughts.
All right. If we don't have anything, I can continue along my merry way.
Sed, did you have something? Looked like you unmuted yourself, but
no, not in particular. I'd love to continue. Let Eric continue on.
Cool.
Great.
So I think I'd like to speak a little more to this concept of kind of a new commonwealth that we're creating. So what would that look like? Like what would it mean if we could actually create a new sort of collective that allows for us to, you know, and I don't want to say necessarily brush off the nation state, but essentially allow for a counterpower against it to operate. And I think what's really important is that this creates a new sort of balancing of power in such a way to where we no longer need to operate through representatives, but essentially like this is sort of a form of direct democracy that's utilizing the Bitcoin blockchain like as our democratic system, if you will, to protect our wealth. Because what's interesting about it is that like as a collective of us as individuals using Bitcoin, we're all given the exact same rights. There's no Bitcoin address that has any sort of exceptions to it or any changes that kind of creates favor to them. And what's so important to me about this is that in our contemporary framework, it's these exceptions that the sovereign can create, usually explicitly through an emergency decree, that has sort of unraveled the entire framework of how our forms of governance are supposed to operate for ourselves. And so if we can start pushing back and challenging power in this sort of explicit way, we create something very new and powerful. And I guess I'll continue down this way a bit and see what questions or challenges people have. In addition to, I very much welcome challenges if people feel differently or disagree with things that I'm saying. But in my most recent piece that was published in 21ism, The Hope of Bitcoin, I sort of go into this idea of the nihilistic death of God and what it would mean to rebuild God. And to me, what we're achieving with technology and the sort of protections and assurances that it offers, I actually believe that Bitcoin is messianic. And I also understand that this word messianism is a pretty loaded word overall. But the reason why I use it is because I believe that Bitcoin is going to escalate into a conflict with the state in such a dramatic way that it's actually going to challenge the power of the state in its entirety. And whether that means that we actually collapse the state and have a revolution that recreates something in its place, or to actually have the state wither away to its entirety to create something different, I think what's happening at this point in time is we have now made a discovery about having this ontological device of wealth, where we can say, hey, you can store your money in this thing. It offers total assurances and rights in a way that no institution, person, or government can guarantee. at any point in time anymore. And that through the ability to keep your wealth and things stored in this, it actually starts to present, in my opinion, what's an astrological question with the state itself. Does the state have a total right over your wealth, or are they going to capitulate and say, hey, we don't have this right? Because I don't imagine any point in time the state does capitulate and say, hey, here are the limits to what we can do. I think they try to go after it full bore. And I think through them trying to go after it full bore, it starts to escalate to such a place to where the state says, you know what? We don't even have an obligation to the law anymore. Like these guys are bad guys. We can go after them and steal their money. And after we've stole their money and we liquidate them, we can do whatever we want with it. To me, this is a principle. Oh, go ahead.
Just a quick clarification we're talking about the state, but we're also talking, you'd also mentioned about certain jurisdictions who could be moving in a more friendly direction towards freedom, which are technically functioning still as states, but I guess you're referencing the state as the larger nation state, who is exercising the control through the rule of the exception, and that could potentially grow into a larger entity than the federal government, even. I think is one thing that comes to mind. But
yeah, and you know, to going further, kind of in this astrology. I do think that part of that is as various federal governments have their powers challenged, I think they're all going to pivot towards a larger global organization to try to create a collective to try to stomp this thing out. And I also think that that's kind of where some of these broader questions get opened, would be like, you know, such as, does this supranational body actually have any legitimacy within our own individual jurisdictions? And essentially, like, as these questions press more and more, it's going to escalate to a conflict where it becomes more and more clear that governments aren't interested in any limits upon their power in any way. And to me, that also proves the nakedness of that they're no longer institutions of law. Because if they're an institution of law, there's clear demarcations and limit to what they can actually do. And there isn't a way for them to step beyond it. And essentially, because they've reserved a right to say, hey, there's actually a place where we can declare the state of emergency so that we can step beyond the demarcation of the law, the state actually finds itself as this institution that's both outside and inside the law. Essentially, it can push itself and take itself beyond what the law is in order to serve whatever purpose it may have. And I think that this is going to become very problematic, because with the trajectory that Bitcoin's going, this is going to be essentially a very explicit and direct attack on the state's ability in order to be able to finance itself. And I think another very important thing I want to point out at is that it was only with governmental discovery of that they can do fiat issuance and debt financing in such a dramatic way that they could create this totally new topology of mechanized war, you know, because up until I'd say like mid 19th century, the operation of financing for war was a very expensive and difficult endeavor. I mean, the fact that fractional reserve banking was created by the King of England in order to be able to raise more money to finance his war against France, I think kind of goes to show its actual origin, you know. And to me, this is another one of the astrological parts of it, is that through removing the power of the purse from any and all states, there becomes this severe limiting factor on their ability to do financing for general wars, you know. And a great example is here in the United States, we spend nearly half of our federal budget on war. And like, that's absolutely and utterly insane, considering that I feel like most people, if I approach them about the question of who and how do you want to make war against other people, they would be uninterested in that. But even with that being true for ourselves, you know, we still have a federal government that has chosen to, you know, essentially use drone bombings as an explicit methodology to try to create Pax Americana in this, you know, pretty damaging and thoughtless way, you know, so that Yemenese children are just afraid to play outside on a clear day. And so to me, through us being able to kind of collectivize our wealth and withdraw it from governments on a much greater level, there becomes this very powerful feature of that we can actually get to a place where we can put constraints on the state vis-a-vis economic and financing capacities directly. And that was always actually something that was intended for our republic. It was just with, and it's pretty funny if any of you are more familiar kind of with the internal political squabbles of the United States, this idea of creating a central bank that could issue fiat money was always a problem, you know, from the very beginning with the conflicts between Alexander Hamilton to it getting recreated as the second bank of the United States a bit later, in addition to Jackson's own fights against it. And then also in the actual Civil War, the first time that we had the issuance of greenbacks happen was essentially to do financing for the Civil War, for the Union cause. And I highlight this because I think that these operations between the state and finance and war are all very important because they have a very deep relationship with each other. And that the actual financial operations of war would become very, very difficult in a world where individuals have sovereignty over their wealth and that wealth can't be discreetly inflated by the powers that be. Any questions at this point? Anybody want to interject, take it in a different direction?
This is Steve. I understand that there's this other realm now with Bitcoin that can separate us from the control and so forth of government or whatever, but it seems like it's an alternate universe that we have to live in this government controlled environment, and we have to, you know, be able to go to the store, buy stuff and get toilet paper and hoard it or whatever. But we need, if our wealth is stored in another dimension, we need these either create an alternate economy within that dimension or find wormholes to get out to the outside world and then come back in our rabbit hole. And I don't see the practicality of all this coming together. In a way that we can live in an alternate reality, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I think you bring up a good point, is that, you know, we do have to live within this world where there is a panopticon deployed, and, you know, we have to go to the grocery store and spend our dollars to get toilet paper or whatever else. And so, you know, I don't think that this is really a fast or a quick fix operation. You know, I think that we're at the very beginning of it. And to answer your question, I actually think that those two methods are how they happen. I think on one hand, we start working with other Bitcoiners specifically to start creating essentially an economic collective of people that are interested in accepting only Bitcoin. Like that's what they choose to utilize and interact with, in addition to the fact that we have other individuals that are saying, hey, we're happy to help you cash out your Bitcoin in different ways. We're happy to give you cash. We're happy to wire that into your bank account, however to it. And so what I see is that this is a start of reclaiming power in a particular way. And not so that, you know, I have total self-sovereignty and efficiency to avoid government and surveillance apparatus today, but more of that 20 years from now, when my son is on the internet and he's interacting with people more, that there is this sort of separate economy where people can interact with each other and pay with Bitcoin being tax-free, that there is the ability to go to a grocery store somewhere and spend from a Bitcoin self-hosted wallet and not need to reveal your financial details. That there essentially becomes a new operation of power to where we no longer just need to resist and hope they don't tear it out of our hands, but we can actually say, hey, you can't take this from us. And I think that that is a very important part of the operation. In addition to, you know, I just want to clarify, I don't think any of these things I've brought up here are single answers. Like, I actually think that we're going to get a huge mix of all of this stuff going on across the board. And that's where the development, I think, is pretty interesting and cool, because I do think that there will be some European states, for example, that will have, you know, pretty friendly legislation all around on how Bitcoin will both be utilized and taxed. And I think that that's one of the more interesting places, is that as this conflict accelerates itself, we are going to see different jurisdictions having different clauses that are more or less friendly according to Bitcoiners. And I do think Bitcoiners will find themselves moving towards those jurisdictions, and not necessarily even actually physically. Like, a good example is is it Latvia that I think is doing a lot of interesting things around the idea of like digital citizenship and whatnot. And so I do feel pretty hopeful that as all of this develops, that, you know, it's not just going to go into outright crazy conflict, but it's going to be a lot more discreet kind of across the board. And it's also going to take a lot longer than any of us believe it will.
One of the things that question, oh, Herman, you got a question too?
Yeah, and no, I just wanted to point out, living in Austria, the narrative here is with Bitcoin that they're really regulating it and they're pushing it in a sense of custodial matters, where, because we're a socialist country here, the majority of the democracy and the people are looking out for you, and they give you your pension and all this. So they give you that money that always has got a use case on it. And they're trying to do that with Bitcoin as well. So the banks are looking after your Bitcoin. And for me, running an ATM and educating people, it's really hard to get that into their heads that, you know, it's your money. It's what you can do with it. You have to look after it. So they don't get it. It's really hard to get that across, because they're educated, you know, people are educated that the government and that trust-based society, that they're this godlike entity, the parliament and the people govern the country, are looking after you. To Lithuania, yeah, they have got their non-fungible tokens like marriage certificates and things already on the blockchain. But it's like, it's just an Excel spreadsheet, but it's centralizedly organized. It's not the distributed ledger. So I just wanted to add this to the conversation here. I mean, I've got some insight into US, so I've been living there as well for a while. So I do get it, and what's going on with the elections. And I'm a mixture of statist and anarchist, I think. A mixture, not a pure anarchist here, but it's
that,
really
that's fair.
Yeah. Sir,
I said that that's fair. I like to believe myself to be a full anarchist, but I think when really pressed, you know, I will acknowledge the need for something similar to a night watchman state or something like that.
Oh yeah, and I do like the idea of rules without a ruler. Yeah, and the new social contracts appearing in a digital age. What we, you know, the transaction is not like a master slave architecture, what we have now. So it's more different transaction levels you have on the Bitcoin, and we can talk and by script, you know, smart contracts like scripts and mini scripts. So, but Thank you. I really like that topic. So nice listening to you.
Thank you. and I appreciate your point that you brought up with you running an ATM. And, you know, I've had similar experiences with working at exchanges in that, you know, a lot of this is very difficult to understand on so many different levels because of the different encounters that are going on. And it goes back to where I started with Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, is that this is all part of a much larger framework of choosing to educate ourselves in such a way so that we do understand what's going on. And with that being said, you know, I don't have a strong faith that, you know, in the next century, we're going to get everybody onboarded with Bitcoin and that people are going to be using it. You know, I think if we get to 10% of the population, we'll be very, very lucky and fortunate. And I think part of it is it is scary and it is difficult. And we have gone through a very deep process of, I suppose I could call it brainwashing. I feel like that's a little too powerful of a term. But I, you know, I'll find this frequently in the United States too, that a lot of people have an idea that, you know, our government is good, they're friendly, they're trying their best, they have noble intentions, they want to keep everyone safe. But I think when we actually look at the actual content of what's going on, as I pointed out earlier, like this coronavirus pandemic has been a great example of seeing how there was a really great opportunity to help us in a very powerful way. And they stepped away from that. They said, oh, we can't find any more money for our average citizen, but we can find more money for the mega corporation. And so I think Bitcoin starts pressing the precipice in this way to where individuals such as ourselves, like, you know, we're really kind of the advanced guard of Bitcoin in a lot of ways, you know, through our own interaction and deeper understanding of it. It now means when we go out into the world and we hear a conversation where somebody's like, oh, that Bitcoin scam thing, I know somebody who lost a bunch of money because they were hacked with it. You know, we can respond to them with like, okay, well, like how were they hacked? Like what happens? And they're like, oh, like, you know, they, you know, Bitcoin can be hacked. And that's where we step in and we can say, well, no, it can't. Like in individuals, they cannot secure their Bitcoin or their private key in a correct way and get hacked. But the system itself, we haven't seen evidence of that happen anytime in the last decade. And so through us engaging in this more critical pedagogy, and I also want to speak to the fact that I think it's very, very important to meet people where they are at with it. Instead of us coming and saying, hey, I have this thing to give to you and to pour into you, it's more of, are you interested in knowing about how fiat money is made? Are you interested in understanding, you know, how the state of emergency allows for governments to go beyond the powers that they were actually given? You know, like, is any of this of interest to you? And I think that that's a really important place to step out, because I personally have never had the experience of trying to quote unquote sell somebody on Bitcoin and have them really come away with a deeper understanding. I have, however, had people reach out to me and say, hey, I'm really interested in this. Like, can you tell me what's going on? And through me being like, yeah, like, what do you know? And for them to say, well, I get that there's this Bitcoin thing. You know, like, that's pretty much it. Well, great. We now have a starting place where we can work through together. And I think that's kind of like the most top level. But I think sort of where we're at here, even with the cosmic deep dive, is like, we can dive really deep. And we can start talking about, so what are our actual social contracts that we're obligated to? How does Bitcoin create this new contract that we can operate with? How can we secure our wealth in such a way that, you know, if I am found guilty of crimes by the state and they come to take my money, how can I make sure that my family can reaccess that in a thoughtful and powerful way that makes sure that the government can't get purview over their funds? And so I think most important in this entire process is just allowing for that questioning to happen, for us to participate with one another in questioning and how we want to do that. You know, and for me, I'm very interested in these more dramatic, I guess, if you will, theological questions about why is it that Bitcoin can give me this promise that seemingly no other institution on the planet can, that literally only a promise from God could fulfill. Like, how is it doing that? You know, and I do think that Bitcoin is an actual ontological object insofar that as we start to interact with Bitcoin, we start to ask ourselves questions about the actual being of man. Like, are we evil? Are we good? Can we utilize this to create a more powerful and perfect republic? Can I interact with this thing in a way that does allow for me to lie or cheat others? And I find it very, very fascinating that explicitly by the framework of us looking at Bitcoin and us trying to secure our wealth, it opens up this space where we start talking about a lot of other very, very important things about our society, like how it's structured, how wealth is allocated, how we can create a new commonwealth. And I also think it's important that it directly addresses a lot of the questions that we've never really gotten to ask before, such as, you know, why is it that the federal government or the European bank gets to create money? How is there oversight or purview into that? You know, is this 2% inflationary figure an actual figure that's representative of everybody that we need? And I think through these sort of critical questionings, we're all going to come to a conclusion of, well, you know, maybe they shouldn't have right over this. And if they are to have right over it, how can we at least limit their power towards it? You know, because I was talking to my wife recently about this. Like, one of the things that hurts me the most about the way that our modern society is set up is that through all of these means of inflation and taxes and other things, people are put onto this constant treadmill of work, and that we're taught that that's the only way that you have value is through selling your labor to somebody else, through you engaging in this process where you give away a third of your life in order to meet somebody else's dreams or accords. And I think that if we all, you know, if somehow magically tomorrow we all converted over to using Bitcoin as our system of wealth storage, we would find that we no longer have to spend a third of our life laboring and selling it in order to create savings for ourselves. That perhaps through us just having an entrepreneurial pursuit where we do have cash flow in and cash flow out, but it's cash flow utilizing this deflationary object, stuff becomes very, very different. You know, and an example that I would point out is, you know, if you were selling a product or good explicitly and only for Bitcoin over the last 5 years, that's essentially doing dollar cost averaging for yourself and savings. And now you have this much, much larger amount of wealth than you would have had before. And so it's actually operating as like a true savings vehicle. Whereas, you know, if we said the same thing for dollars, all that we would have is, you know, our dollar amount, which, seeing how things are going right now, it's pretty clear that the purchasing power of that is maybe 5 to 10% less than it was before. And so I think engaging in these sort of questionings with people about like how money operates, how savings operates, why we would want to choose Bitcoin, what are the risks that get involved with it, it's all a very important part of the conversation in trying to get people to understand better. But as I pointed out earlier, like, I think it's really, really important to meet people where they're at, because I've found just for myself that when people are trying to get me to sell them on it, they're not really interested. They most people just want to know how and why number goes up. And I go, look, if that's what you're interested in, get yourself on an exchange, buy some Bitcoin, set a limit order to sell, and there you go. In and out, you got more dollars. Good for you. But if I find that they're actually asking more questions of why is it going up in value, you know, what does it mean to take it off of exchange, you know, in addition to like how could I use the dark net markets to, you know, maybe get cancer medication for my mother or, you know, whatever they need, that's when stuff starts to get a lot more interesting. And I think that we can engage it more, you know, and for you folks that are farther down the rabbit hole, you know, like I want to start entertaining these notions of like, maybe it is actually astrological, like maybe because of the way that this allows for us to take a totally new power into our own hands, maybe it challenges the power structure of the world in such a dramatic and powerful way that it changes the dynamics entirely. And I mean, so essentially at the end of like what my thesis is with Bitcoin and its theological, I think because of the way that we can reclaim power for ourselves and participate in this totally new collective where it can't be violently extracted from us, I think this runs headlong into an encounter with the state where they say, look, if you're utilizing Bitcoin, you're our enemy and we get to attack you. And to me, like that's essentially a presentation of a conflict between good and evil. The state saying we have ultimate right and power over you no matter what. And you're saying, no, you don't actually. And I'm utilizing this other format that protects me in a different way. And what becomes really interesting is that, you know, if the state comes and attacks me, it's too bad for me, but my wealth is still saved. And now I can actually like have my wealth go out there and avenge me in whatever way I see fit, whether it's just giving itself over to my family and friends, or, you know, maybe I use a dead man's key in some novel way to try to get people to liberate me. Maybe we start organizing collectively so that this gets paid into a lawyer that protects anybody who are jailed under these decrees. But what's so important to me is that like now there becomes very realistic and powerful ways for people to resist and fight back. And I think with each step forward we move in Bitcoin, that becomes more and more powerful. And what I would love to see is for my predictions of this outright conflict with the state to be totally wrong, and to find that we get friendly and thoughtful legislation that respects people's rights to privacy and their right to own their own wealth, and that the state will recognize that and allow for us to move forward collaboratively. Seeing the legislation that's coming through from the Treasury Department that may pass next week, I don't feel as confident about that, but you know, it's I always want to try to look on the brighter side of this and try to offer opportunity for things to be more positive than to be more negative.
100%. In that realm, one thing I'd love to get your thoughts on is, before we get your closing thoughts, is one of the things, George, who just jumped into the conversation, you're welcome to unmute yourself too and chime in here. But one of the things that we were talking about is, recently we've seen some two sheriff's departments actually come out against the state of California, saying that they're not going to enforce the so-called lockdown rules, and they're not going to just follow willy-nilly what the state is issuing out in terms of their subjective decrees. And that, I think, offers a lot of hope for people who are actively a part of this like enforcement structure of the state, who it offers opportunity for them to withdraw their support. And I think that's a really important point for us to focus on in terms of communicating with these people who are actively doing that, who are seeing the problems of, you know, in their own way. Maybe this sheriff, you know, so Riverside County Sheriff and Orange County Sheriff, maybe they don't have a fully anarchic view of things. I highly doubt that. And they don't maybe have an understanding of Bitcoin and how that relates. But I think that's an exciting opportunity for us to potentially interact with these institutions who are wielding very tangible power or control in their specific jurisdiction, like namely the ability to go into the streets with guns and enforce laws. So I think that's a very exciting thing that I'd love to hear your thoughts on, Eric. And George, feel free to chime in.
Can I jump in just to add to that real quick? Thanks so much for allowing me to unmute myself. And I've enjoyed listening to you chat, Eric. I'm with you. And we need more pragmatic type solutions and more bigger picture thinking about the implications of sort of this transition. Because I think it's a tremendous responsibility and opportunity at the same time. I'm in Orange County and watching sort of the exodus take place right before our eyes. As a parent and someone who's, you know, just thinking about the future for my kids, it's, I think at some level you have to ask yourself the question, like, okay, what is the best move? Is it, should I follow everyone that's going to Austin right now? Or, you know, that kind of sounds like, it kind of feels like, and no disrespect to anyone who is, if that is your best option, but you know, it feels like running away a little bit, like, and at some level we gotta get ready to fight, and we gotta get ready to figure out like what does it look like to take our power back. And as John is saying, like, maybe there are some real opportunities here with some of the people who are in charge of enforcement to say, look guys, why don't we just stand our ground? You know, we already got these boundaries that are kind of arbitrary, but like, you're in charge of them, and the citizens here obviously are all about not all of them, but some of them, Orange County in particular, it seems like there's a lot of more freedom-minded people. So how do we take something like that and actually implement it into the real world?
Great question. Well, I think it's a two-tiered approach. You know, I think, first of all, this way that we have enforcement broken up into the United States into local jurisdictions is pretty great, because we'll probably find a lot of pockets throughout the United States where there are sheriff and law enforcers that are pro-Bitcoiner, and that they wouldn't kind of implement legislation that was passed around this to say, hey, show up to somebody's house and steal their Bitcoin. And I think this kind of speaks back to what I was talking about earlier about us already being at civil war. One of the things I think is really interesting is that like Bitcoin's sort of this backdoored secret war on people on their own, you know, because we do actually have US senators and representatives that are Bitcoiners. We do have state legislatures and sheriffs, you know, that are Bitcoiners. And so I think that through the actual direct education of these individuals, why it's important and how it's powerful, is a very real and important component of doing that. And the second one is like, and essentially like this is one of my biggest fantasies and one of the things I've been waiting around to pop up for really the last 8 years is I do think a political organization needs to come about and is necessary, you know? And even saying that as an anarchist, I cringe a little bit for myself, but you know, this is a place that I'm willing to compromise and capitulate, because I think that this is a very powerful and thoughtful strategy, you know, and to me, what I would love to see more than anything would actually be essentially a political organization that takes more of this kind of anarchist approach to individual education, helping them, you know, understand how to secure their Bitcoin, how to use cryptography, how to have secure communication, how to manage their UTXO sets, those sort of things. But in addition to, they want to go and actually talk to state legislatures. And what I would love to see more than anything is there's a clause in the Constitution called Article 9, I think, of the Constitution. And essentially utilizing that, states individually can pass legislation to amend the US Constitution. And I would just love like a flat out, like, Bitcoin is recognized as being private money that individuals can utilize and hold, and like the federal government has no right into the surveillance or understanding of how people are utilizing that. And it's just recognized as being legal tender across the board. And I think legislation like that would really help open us up to going back towards how currencies were issued in the United States between 1830 and 1860, the wildcat banking era. And I think that's really important because, like, once essentially we take power of the federal government away from having a monopoly around currency issuance, like, that's where stuff can get really interesting and cool. And as much as I would like for it to, like, unilaterally just be Bitcoin, I don't foresee that happening. And I think that's fine. You know, like, I'm totally cool with Bitcoin playing out in the marketplace of ideas and, you know, beating out shitcoins. I think it's already naturally doing that. And I've always had a very laissez-faire approach to, like, how shitcoin should be addressed. You know, like, I think they're interesting speculative instruments. I think that there are some projects that even have real promise in a number of different ways. Is it money? I don't think so. Are they free to contend in the market with it as being money? Yeah, I welcome that. I'm happy to take your Satoshis in order to let you pump a little. That's fine. So I guess it's that sort of two-pronged approach. One is individual education. The second is essentially education towards legislatures. And in my fantasy world, you know, as Bitcoiners, we get together a bankroll of $100 million. We essentially approach different state legislatures being like, look, we know you're corrupt, shifty little fucks. We'll give you $20,000 if you sponsor our legislation. And if not, you know, we'll use that $20,000 to attack you and to give that, you know, an extra $20,000 to your opponent who will support our legislation. Nothing like that has came up yet. If anybody wants to start it, I totally welcome and celebrate you doing that. And yeah, I also think that, like, if we had hardcore legislation come down, such as a 6102 event, I do think that there's a lot of solace in that we could actually fall back onto individual enforcers and sheriffs within counties to say, hey, don't do this. This is a bad idea. So I hope that addresses some of your question, George.
Yeah, thank you. Can I just ask a follow-up real quick, too?
Absolutely.
So, because you mentioned basically aligning with these politicians' incentives, and why not, right? Thinking about that, a similar strategy, but maybe in a less, I don't know. I'm just thinking about the military, I guess. You think about people that are enrolled in the military, and we've met a lot of great ones that come out to our Bitcoin meetup. And there's so much disillusionment with all of the corruption and all of that. But you think about the people on the ground, ultimately are just, you know, a lot of them just normal people, and they're getting paid a paycheck to carry out these marching orders. You know, something like your $100 million fund to basically hire people who have incentives that are not that great. I mean, I think we really do got to start thinking about what it looks like to wield some of this power that we're coming into. And I think strategies like that could work. But what do you think about something similar from a military perspective?
When you say from a military perspective, such as, like, you have this fund and perhaps they're given marching orders to, you know, go seize Bitcoin or something. And essentially we're saying, hey, don't do that. And, like, we got your back for, you know, wages or whatever.
Right. Come work for us.
Yeah. You know, I do think that that's an interesting approach. And I actually think, to me, like, this is kind of where the entire panopticon operation of Bitcoin starts to come in this really interesting way. Because I could imagine in a similar approach, too, it's essentially saying, hey, if you do want to stand in our way, like, we're going to identify you, we're going to out you to your family, your friends, your community, all those other people as being, like, this person that wants to utilize violence and hurt people for what we're doing. You know, and I do think having a fund to kind of protect people who want to refuse those orders or whatever is definitely a thoughtful approach. But I think kind of going at it more upfront from the political route directly, I think would probably be more beneficial. I'm pretty surprised something like this hasn't gotten together already, because I think we have a substantial amount of enough of money at this point to where it could be really powerful, in addition to trying to get legislation passed for an amendment to the United States, fully circumnavigating Congress. I think really on anything would be pretty, like, entertaining to most people to go, like, oh, like, we can actually amend the U.S. Constitution without these asshats getting in the way. Which I'll, I also want to point out, trying to amend the U.S. Constitution using Article 9, it's like still a radical thing. Like, we've never actually had that happen. And like, it scared the shit out of Congress so much that they've just like passed through amendments anytime it's looked like something was going to pass, utilizing this Article 9 clause within the Constitution.
Can you quickly outline what that process is?
What Article 9 is?
Yes. Yeah.
What Article 9 is, it explicitly says, if each state legislature passes their own legislation within the state saying we want an amendment to the U.S. Constitution for X, if you get 35 states, more than two-thirds, that say that same thing, it is supposed to be amended to the United States Constitution unilaterally. There's not supposed to be any more process that happens with that. However, there was a Supreme Court decision that happened in 1908 and another one in 1963 that essentially, because what stipulates in the Constitution is that like once that's passed, it either gets amended to the Constitution directly or there's a constitutional convention to discuss that amendment. The thing that's unclear is who would be part of this constitutional convention and what would they have the power to amend directly. And part of the reason why they've never let it happen is that there's this deep fear that an Article 9 constitutional convention could actually allow for a full rewriting of the Constitution from top to bottom, as opposed to addressing just that specific amendment. So it's all sort of a legal mystery at this point in time. But I do think that's like an interesting kind of tactical approach, if you will, towards making that happen. I mean, hell, the other one that I think would be even more interesting would be if Bitcoiners just kind of created their own unilateral political party that was like, I don't even know how it would be classified. But essentially the idea is like, elect one dude as president of the United States to like go ram through all his legislation. That seems much less likely considering how difficult it is to have any logical dialogue on a national level. And that's one of the reasons why I think targeting state legislatures and focusing on that project state by state would be more viable. But, you know, I'm open to it. I just think there's a very real need and responsibility to start looking at this in a more contemporary political fashion. And as much as I have my own fantasies about it just being this crazy anarchic resistance movement, I think the truth is that if we organized ourselves into a more traditional political format, there might be a lot more wins that could happen.
Love that. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks, Eric.
Yeah. Well, before I wrap up here, I just kind of want to open it up. If anybody has any other questions specifically about my writings or anything that I brought up here, I'm really happy to address it. And I also just kind of want to, on a closing note, point out, like, this is all just part of my own process of curiosity, of trying to get a deeper and more thorough understanding of this. And I think that journey is a really interesting and important facet of it, because not only have I learned a whole lot more about Bitcoin, but it's also allowed for me to reflect more deeply upon myself and who I want to be and how I want to interact with the world. And also just, you know, my actual approach to savings and money and finance and, you know, I'm not good with taxes or 401ks or any of that stuff. And I think through my own approach of trying to understand Bitcoin more deeply, it's allowed for me to approach all of these other subjects that perhaps before I would have been much more shy about trying to broach on my own. And so I think that that's just something I want to point out and keep in mind, is that, you know, we're all here to learn and empower ourselves. And through you making the choice to push through those difficult places where maybe you don't understand something, or maybe you're having a hard time grasping something, that through pushing deeper into those spots, you will achieve that understanding and it will offer you more for yourself moving forward.
That's an amazing place to leave things off. I do want to open it up to anyone else who wants to chime in with it. Final questions or our thoughts reflecting on what Eric has shared so far?
Absolutely. Anybody has something? I'm more than happy.
Well, if no one else has anything to ask, I just want to say, Eric, it was a phenomenal session. It leaves all of us with just a tremendous amount to think about and to really implement into our own lives. Like, I'm very inspired and I'm challenged to really press into the ways in which I feel inadequate. You know, that this morning's technical discussion around Taproot was definitely something that pushed the boundaries of my intellect, you know, and I've really enjoyed that. I'm glad that happened. And this as well is, you know, inspires me to think honestly about where my vulnerabilities are and just press into that. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean that I need to take some drastic, desperate action right away, but that really is what this whole process is about. So I really appreciate you taking the time to walk us through some of your own thought processes. And I think all of us really benefited a lot. And I think this will help a lot of people to see just the massive implications of this new technology and how connected all of these things are, from like this massive political, geopolitical realm and spiritual realm to just how we can live like a better life in the here and now. All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that. This discussion is just so prescient. It's so practical. And I'm really grateful for Eric for leading us through this. And I'm really grateful to you guys for listening in as always. If you like this episode, feel free to hit the like button, subscribe. But more importantly, be sure to share it. Share this with anyone that you might find that resonates with this message, and get the word out, because I think that what Eric is talking about here would be really helpful for some people to understand and to just gain a higher level view of what is actually going on right now, how these actors are interacting in the political realm. So share away. If you want to check out more episodes, events, or learn more how to support the show, feel free to visit thebitcoinpath.com. And until next time, may you live a meaningful life and enjoy your freedom as a sovereign individual.